YFM in Philadelphia. My name's Danny Miller. I'm sitting in this week and next for Terry Gross. Right now, I'd like to welcome quarterback Joe Namath, who led one of the most exciting careers in pro football. Joe Willie Namath came to success from a modest background, having grown up in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, a small steel town near Pittsburgh. When he joined the New York Jets in 1965 with a much-publicized $427,000 contract, he was the highest-paid rookie in pro sports. In 1969, he led the underdog Jets to a stunning 16-7 victory over the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. A Time magazine cover photograph of Namath in his football gear, set in the middle of Times Square, earned him the nickname Broadway Joe. Because of knee problems which dated back to his childhood, it was predicted that his career in football would only last 5 years. Well, it lasted 13, and he was the first quarterback to pass for over 4,000 yards in a season, and last summer he entered the Football Hall of Fame. Throughout his career and following his retirement from pro football, Joe Namath was in top demand by Madison Avenue, employing his successful Playboy image to promote cologne, shaving cream, and underwear. And for the past several years, Joe Namath has acted on stage and in film. He appeared on Broadway in 1983 with Michael Moriarty in a production of The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. Joe Namath has kept in touch with football through his instructional football camp, which he's operated for 15 years, and he's just written a book about how to play the game titled Football for Young Players and Parents, which has just been published by Simon & Schuster. Well, it's really a great pleasure to have you here, Joe Namath.
Well, thank you, Danny.
Lots of people have been looking forward to seeing you at the station. You grew up in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, which I understand was a fairly depressed coal town and steel town outside of Pittsburgh. Did you see pro sports as a way of achieving success and fortune, as a way out of town in any way?
No, Dan. At the time, it was a way to get to college playing football, but certainly not going into professional football. That wasn't my goal. Beaver Falls, by the way, located 28 miles northwest of Pittsburgh, was a steel town, and it's depressed a bit now. Back then, it certainly wasn't depressed because the four small steel mills we had were functioning nicely. As you well know, these days, our steel industry is really down and out, and a lot of people are hurting back home. My entire family still lives there, my mother and brothers and sister and nieces and nephews. You know, it's home.
You played pool a lot, I understand. Did you make money?
I lost probably more money than I ever made playing pool, but sure, I enjoyed pool. I'll tell you what happened. When I first moved into my third apartment, I guess it was, in New York City, I finally had a room large enough for a pool table. About eight of my pals chipped in and surprised me with a pool table. And I still have it in my home in California, but I don't play as often as I used to. Yeah, I used to like pool. Where'd you find that?
Some Sports Illustrated article or something like that.
Yeah, I used to like
it. Or I think your mother wrote about it, actually, in the book that she wrote about you.
I don't know. I guess Music Man gave pool rooms a bad name or something. Pool rooms don't have to be bad places, you know. They can be fun to hang out in.
What was your main sport when you were a kid? What were you most interested in?
Baseball, basketball, and football were the three sports that we played back home. Hockey wasn't that big. Soccer certainly wasn't around at the time, and I am a good believer in soccer, by the way. I think it's a great sport. It can develop a lot of, the motor movements, and it's a team game. It's really a good sport. I'd like to see it catch on even better here in this country. But football, basketball, and baseball were the three sports we played.
How did you pick the University of Alabama when you were looking for a college? Because that would be a big jump from you out of town.
I had several opportunities, fortunately, scholarship offers at the time. First of all, because of my high school coach, we got a new high school coach my junior year in high school. And my senior year, 13 of us got scholarships to college, thanks to him, you know. So I had some scholarship offers, but my brother Frank, I guess, helped me a great deal. I know he helped me a great deal in deciding where to go by being honest. I had a lot of offers that included money and monthly payments. And my brother told me, Joe, you know, they're breaking the rules. That's not fair. They're cheating. He said, now, do you want to go to work with people like this, or, you know, you want to go to work with somebody good? I know the money sounds good, he says, but what kind of people do you want to be around? It wasn't 2 days later that Howard Schnellenberger came to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Now, Howard Schnellenberger is the head football coach at the University of Louisville right now. He was at Miami 2 years ago, and they won the national championship. Anyway, Howard was coaching at the University of Alabama under Coach Bryant. Howard had been at the University of Kentucky when my brother was there, so they knew each other, see? And Howard was one of the honest guys, and Alabama was one of the honest scholarships. And I actually went to Alabama more because of Howard Schnellenberger than Coach Bryant, because I really didn't know that much about Coach Bryant at the time. Certainly had I known him better, I would have gone there a lot faster. But Howard Schnellenberger is the one that got me to go to Alabama because of my brother Frank.
What type of recollections do you have about Bear Bryant at the University of Alabama?
99% good recollections, that's for sure. We love him, we miss him. He was a hard-working, honest man, and I think those are the things that were most important for his success. So that's why he succeeded, because he didn't ask anybody to do anything he wouldn't do, and he expected everyone to help one another. You know, you had a responsibility, own up to it, live up to it. He was a hard-working, honest man is what he was, and he was a tough man, too. I mean, I remember my freshman year, Coach Bryant, he's about 6'5", and he was he was still strong at the time, let me put it that way. And he asked me a question on the football. Well, he didn't quite ask me a question on a football field. I ran an option play, pitched the ball, and there was a fumble. Well, I didn't get to the ball, and Coach Bryant was talking to me in football talk. You know, hey, Namath, you know, it's not just your job to pitch the ball, but if something goes wrong, get up, get after it, or whatever. And I was walking back to the huddle listening to him, looking down at the ground, saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. Boy, about that time my head jerked up. He had me by the headgear, and he said, son, when I talk to you, you look me in the eye and call me sir. I said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he got my attention. That was his way of getting my attention, you might say, at the time. And from that day on, I did learn to look a man in the eye if you have something to say or if you listen to him. And it makes a difference, I believe. But Coach Bryant, oh, God, there are a lot of good memories. And as I said earlier, we miss him for sure.
Well, I read in one place that there was a time that he was about to show you how to throw a football, and then he said to himself, well, you know, wait a minute, you've thrown so many more footballs than I have. And it was a really interesting type of style to let you kind of, he knew that you were learning more on your own. What was that about?
It was funny. I swear, I was warming up before practice one day, and I couldn't get the ball to have a tight spiral on it. It was wobbling through the air, and he was watching the ball fly through the air, wobbling. It came back to me. I caught it, and he said, let me have that ball there, Joe. Yes, sir. He said, looky here. He said, it seems to me that if you hold the ball this way, and then he stopped, and he looked at me. He said, what am I doing? You know how to pass a football better than I do. And he just threw it back in my hands and walked away, and I thought that was great.
Was he at all concerned about your schoolwork that
day? Oh, absolutely. They did a wonderful job at Alabama and still do a wonderful job at Alabama. They furnish tutors. They don't let you leave the dormitory, as a matter of fact, until you've had your study lessons that night. And they also have mandatory requirement for attending classes. When Coach Bryant was there, if we had one cut above three for any one class, we had study hall with Coach Bryant at 5 a.m. in the morning in his office. And believe me, no one wanted to see Coach Bryant in his office for doing something wrong at 5 a.m. or any other time. Yeah, he had ways of enforcing his rules, and they were good rules.
Did you ever have trouble fitting in the South? I'm thinking that you came from what was a predominantly black neighborhood.
I was the only white starter on a basketball team in Beaver Falls, and our neighborhood was predominantly black and Hungarians and Italians, you know, a nice group, a nice mixture. I went to Alabama without having visited there. I may not have gone there had I visited first, but I went there and I saw water fountains with the word colored and the other fountain with the word white. I didn't know that existed. I really did not. I was shocked. I didn't know that existed. I got on a bus to go to Birmingham the first day I was down there. And, you know, back home, the guys, we get on a bus, we automatically go to the back of the bus, it seemed, you know, when we were in high school and stuff. That's where we rode. I got on a bus, I sit down, and next thing you know, there aren't any white people sitting around me. They're all sitting up front in the first couple of rows, and You know, I was back here with the black people. Well, it was like home to me. It didn't make any difference, so I just sat there. You know, I put my hat down. I had a tough time my first year there. The guys knew I was from Pennsylvania. They knew I had some very close friends that were black. And we didn't get along well down there my first year. I tried to quit, actually, about 15 times. And Coach Bryant was able to work it out to where I wouldn't quit. He kept talking to me and then got me to stay. But the South has come a long way since then. There's been some great improvements with the racial issues and human rights, and we still have a long way to go all over this country and other places around the world, true. But the South has changed for the better, and let's hope every place keeps changing for the better. But it was tough, yeah. It was strange, man. We didn't have, I remember when we integrated there at the University of Alabama, it was weird. I couldn't believe why people were getting upset over this, you know, because I'm raised here in PA, you know. You treat people the way you want to be treated, the way you want people to treat your family and friends. That's the way I believe in getting along. And it was awesome to me. I remember the whole campus was barricaded. I remember seeing George Wallace, our governor, the governor of Alabama, standing in the doorway of the registration office saying, "We will not allow this Vivian Malone to register in this University of Alabama." And before he was finished with the sentence, the man stepped over and said, "Governor Wallace, you step aside now. This is a federal matter." And Governor Wallace stepped aside. She went in, and everything went well after that, you know. But I guess it did take some intervention there federally to get it going properly. But I love the South. I love the people there. They got sidetracked early on with the racial problems and segregation, but we're getting back on the right track.
Was the football team integrated after that?
Nope. Oh, after that, sure. But the entire Southeastern Conference didn't have any black players. I remember the first black player at the University of Maryland, and that didn't happen until about 61. And his name was Hill, Tony Hill, I believe. But he was the first black player at the University of Maryland. No, we didn't. The SEC, Southeastern Conference, University of Alabama, did not integrate until the later, late 60s, maybe even early 70s. And I remember talking with Coach Bryant about it and how he was going to handle it. He told me, he said, "Joe, I'm not going to bring one boy in here to take this on by himself." He said, "We're going to integrate. I'm going to bring in 10, 15 guys. I want them to feel at home. I want to do this thing right to begin with. I'm not going to put all the pressure on one boy, one young man." And that's what he did. And it was a brilliant idea, and it worked. And there haven't been problems there. And, you know, every place should run as smoothly as Alabama these days, I think.
My guest is Joe Namath, and he's just written a book. It's an instructional book on football for kids and parents. It's called Football for Young Players and Parents. When you signed with the New York Jets, it was said that you were the highest paid rookie in pro sports at that time. Did your teammates resent you at all?
Absolutely.
How did they make that clear?
Oh, it's called English language. "Hey, you bum, you don't deserve that money. What are you doing? You rookie, you." I got called a lot of names, and you know, I couldn't hold it against those guys. The ones that were upset just didn't know, and I wasn't aware of it either, but there was a trend. Things were changing, and this was part of the change. This initiated part of the change. And for the betterment for paydays, by the way, for ball players, to where it's gotten, I don't know what to call it now. They make a lot of money now, too. Numbers that I can't quite fathom. But, yeah, they resented it. And, hey, I can't blame them. Like I say, one guy's played his whole career, maybe 10 years, and didn't make as much as they were giving me to start with, you see. And there just wasn't that kind of money around. There wasn't television. Prior to that, they didn't have the stadiums, the facilities. You know, the numbers kept changing, and some of the ball players just didn't recognize it.
I guess it was television that really made it possible to pay that type of superstar salary.
Absolutely, yeah, especially today in the last 10 years. We had a brilliant owner, one of the owners. The Jets, of course, have a few owners. Mr. Hess is the sole owner now. But Mr. Werblin, Sonny Werblin, was the one of the owners at the time, and he believed in the star system. Well, there wasn't any place in football for the star system. At least that's what the old school football people felt. And, you know, football is a team game, and they wanted everybody to be treated the same. Well, Mr. Werblin didn't believe that. He was a great agent in his time, representing a lot of people. They started MCA. Anyway, he knew that the star system would fill a stadium or sell tickets. So he went out and he got Matt Snell the year before me, started the ball rolling. Then the next year I came in to play, and we had a stadium sold out. Well, you know, that was great. He accomplished something. For the money he paid me, he couldn't have bought our league, the AFL, or the New York Jets that much publicity if he had to pay for it. You know, that was really a cheap buy, ultimately, and it worked out. If I had not been a decent player, it would have been a disaster. But fortunately, thank God, I was able to stay physically fit enough to play, and I was able to show that I was a good athlete, and our team developed, and we ended up winning the championship. You know, so it's a story with a happy ending, except this part of it is not over yet. This story, Joe, it's not over yet.
It Joe's right here.
A happy ending.
Joe
yeah.
Namath is right here. You were under a lot of pressure to produce. Your teammates were resenting you for making so much money. The team had invested so much money into you. It was thought that your career might be rather short because your knees might give out. How did that affect you? Did you respond good to the pressure? Did that make it more difficult?
Well, it made it more difficult, but it made me a better man for sure. You mentioned the knees. I remember the first operation I had in New York. The doctor came in afterwards, said, Joe, everything went fine. We think you'll be able to play 4 years. I said, gee, that's great, man. I can play 4 years of professional football. Well, I did get lucky. I ended up playing 13. But whenever I started out, I was given 4 years by the doctor, and I thought that would be good. So there was that pressure. You know, I had a tremendous amount of confidence on the football field. So that was like my hiding place, believe it or not. I may have been out there in front of 80,000 people, but for me, I was at home on the football field. The rest of the place, the rest of the time when we were doing interviews or talking at television and there people keep talking about pressure, I was a little uncomfortable then. But it certainly didn't. I knew I had to own up, but I always felt that way. I always felt that way anyway, and that, again, that comes from home. You know, if you have a responsibility, live up to it, work at it. Well, you know, when you're a quarterback, your team's counting on you to do a lot of things. And fortunately, I was a God-gifted, a good athlete, and I didn't feel the pressure while I was playing.
When you came from Alabama and joined the Jets and then found yourself playing pro football, how much more painful and physically demanding, how much more difficult was the game on a professional level?
Oh, well, it is different for sure. It's a much finer game on a professional level. But what I had happen to me was difficult in the sense that, well, I don't know, you take a racehorse, and if a racehorse hurts his leg and then tries to run, it's a drag, you know. It's an awful effort. We mentioned, I am saying I didn't feel the pressure. Well, you know, there were times, of course, I knew things were happening, but once the game got started is what I meant by not feeling the pressure. I was able to handle it once it got down to work time. The other times, yeah, it was tough. Being injured, not being able to run was the problem with me. I was the fastest kid on the block back in Pennsylvania, back in Beaver Falls anyway. I could run. And all of a sudden, I had torn cruciate ligaments, torn medial ligament, and torn medial cartilage all at the same time. The right leg was just not the same. I really couldn't run as well. And so that changed the game for me some, but not so badly as tearing two hamstring muscles in my left leg in a water skiing accident. In about 71, I severed both hamstring muscles, two of the hamstring muscles up at the top of the leg, and I literally could not and cannot run 4 steps straight ahead. The leg will not stride. It won't stretch out. Well, I played my last 4 or 5 years of professional football not being able to run straight ahead 4 steps. That was a drag. That was not fun at all. That was a different way of playing the game. I got sick and tired of that, and I knew I didn't belong anymore. That's the year I retired. I never looked back because I just didn't belong. I just physically could not handle it. I couldn't play. People thought that my knees were so bad, you know, I couldn't run. It wasn't my knees necessarily. It wasn't my knees that caused me to actually retire or caused me not to be able to run. It was my left leg hamstring, and it happened in a water skiing accident. The rope broke, of all things. Brand new rope, never been used before. Took it out of the box. It was just coming out of the water, and it snapped and severed two hamstring muscles. What a drag. Well, it wasn't fun playing those last 4 or 5 years that way.
When you would have started with the Jets, I'd imagine one change from college football is that the opposing team, the defensive linemen that are supposed to rush you and bring you down, I mean, these guys are probably bigger, stronger, and at least more experienced and better at their jobs than the guys you would have faced in college. Did that intimidate you at all?
No, it didn't intimidate me. I certainly did respect them, though. Called most of them sir for a while and called a lot of other ones a lot of other names, too. No, you're right. They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. Football at a professional level is a full-time job. In college, hopefully we're there for the education. Hopefully, you know, the football is a part of it, a part of your life at the time. Well, football, again, like I say, in pro ball, it is serious work time year-round. And so you're competing against not only bigger, stronger, faster guys, but smarter guys. And the game is a much finer game.
Was there a psychological level of intimidation on the football field? For instance, what might happen in a boxing ring?
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah, before a game, guys would scream at you, "I'm going to break your leg," or "I'll bust your neck." Of course, yeah. Yeah, that intimidation goes in sports. It's real.
How would you respond?
I'd laugh or I'd cry, one of the two. I don't know. No, I didn't cry on the field. But, you know, it's the old story goes in one ear and out the other. Having been around it enough from Western Pennsylvania, hey, Western Pennsylvania and all of Pennsylvania is one of the great sports states. We have a lot of great athletes here, and if you could hold your own back in Western PA in the WPIAL, you had a lot of confidence in your ability, and it carried all the way through to professional football.
So what finer points, what subtler points of how to play the game did you have to learn when you joined the Jets in your first couple of years?
Well, professional football is more sophisticated. Teams do more things. Individuals can do more things. They have more time to work on things. Professionally, the defenses that are run are much better. There is a much larger variety of defenses, and the quarterback has to learn to read these defenses, hopefully ahead of time, before the ball's even snapped. If not then while he's going back to pass, for example. And when you can mix in, when a defense has in their repertoire any one of, they can use any one of 23 or 4 different pass coverages, it takes a lot of learning, and repetition is about the only way to do it, man, to get out there and work it and work it and work it. The best years I played football were my first 5 years in professional football, I felt, because I was well-oiled. I didn't miss a game for my first 5 years, even though I had a few operations in between. I did not miss one football game my first 5 years. And when we went to the Super Bowl my fourth year, man, I was hot. You know, I'd been playing every down, man. I was well-oiled. What I learned after that from being hurt, from having a broken wrist, a shoulder, different injuries that had happened during the season, I couldn't play as well when I'd get hurt and have to come back. If you have to sit out for 3 or 4 months, doesn't go back to work, you're just not going to work as well in most jobs anyway. Ali tried to come back and, you know, boxing there a little late, talking about Sugar Ray Leonard maybe coming back. And I wouldn't suggest that to Sugar. Of course, you know, he knows what he's doing. But when a guy gets out of that regular work routine, he's not going to be as sharp when he comes back. And I had a tough time because of the injury factors, missing games and coming back to play, missing games and coming back to play. You mentally don't react the same. You don't react as quickly, and you're physically not on top of it.
My guest is Joe Namath. You mentioned that because of your knees, you wouldn't be doing as much running, especially in the latter part of your career. Did the other team play you in a specific way? Was that something that the opposing team could exploit?
Absolutely, sure. What you do is try to put pressure up the middle on a guy that can't get out of the pocket.
Yeah, can you explain what you
mean
by that?
Sure, you know, you've seen quarterbacks get the ball from center, go back to throw the ball. Well, what a defense would do and will do with a man that's not mobile is put the pressure in front of him, try and force people back onto him. Not necessarily the defense, but try and push the blockers back into him because they know he's not going to escape from side to side. Plus, that's the shortest route. You know, the shortest route between two points is straight ahead.
So the guy.
They put, sure. Now, if you have a Montana right now who can move around, he's an excellent pocket passer, but he's also got some good feet. Fred Astaire, the quarterbacks, I think. Anyway, they have a problem with Montana because he can jump out of the pocket, you see. So what they have to do with him is put pressure on the outsides as well as up the middle. See, it's more difficult for the defense. But with me, especially late when I couldn't get out of the pocket right or left, sure, they'd concentrate right up the middle. Maybe they couldn't get to me, but they'd block your vision, too. You know, I'm 6'2 when I stand straight, and the football shoes made me a little taller, but I'd have a tough time seeing with these guys coming in. I remember playing against Kansas City Chiefs. They had two fellas in the middle. One was Buck Buchanan, who was 6'7", and the other one was Ernie Ladd, who was 6'9". And they looked like the Twin Towers of New York coming in there rushing with their arms. That was very difficult to see. So, yeah, defenses, the smart defenses would attack an immobile quarterback that way.
Now, would your coaches or the management of the team encourage you to play in any particular way to protect your knees? Because that's an investment in you.
It's next impossible other than wearing braces. You know, we didn't have braces back then, preventative braces that would prevent injuries. They have them today. You'll see a lot of quarterbacks especially wearing them today. And I think they should because the knee was just not designed, unfortunately. Was not designed to be bent sideways. You know, laterally, it just wasn't designed that way. And in football, sometimes you can suffer a hit. It can be painful.
Is there a kind of a typical personality or set of attributes for a good quarterback?
Oh, well, to be an ideal quarterback, all good quarterbacks have to have a lot of fight in them. I mean, they have to be tough, sometimes even mean. You have to be mentally sharp. Otherwise, you won't be able to comprehend not only your offense but the other team's defense. You have to be very quick-minded in order to be able to recognize something on the football field, see a guy that's limping, be able to change your play instantly. I mentioned earlier about hopefully recognizing what kind of coverage a defense would use before the snap of the ball even. Other than being one of the best athletes on the team, you should have quick feet, good hands, good head, and all those things add up.
Well, I don't mean this in a critical way, but in a positive way. Do you think it helps to like thrive on attention and being in control since the quarterback is, you know, just in a personality way, is that it?
You learn, and one of the things we show in this book, I try to explain to people, we don't do very much on our own in life. Football is a great eye-opener for that. I don't care how good you think you are. Somebody's going to get your number. If your teammates don't help you, you're going to get had, Jack. You know, and that's the way life is, too. It's a team game. And up at our boys' camp, we show these boys to learn the right way to go about things, to learn to work together. And football's a good way to teach some of these kids. You know, there's some guys that are good runners, you know, they can run fast. Hey, you're not going to outrun everyone all day long on a football field. And in life, you learn to respect one another and work with one another, too, you know, away from football. That ego problem, it's good to be confident, but you stop being cocky if you have any good sense at all. You know, you're going to get beaten up a few times on a football field. You always come across a better player, a better team, or a team that has their day, or you make mistakes. When I was at the top of my game, I mentioned my first 5 years, I still made mistakes, and I was at the top of my game. You know, we can make mistakes anytime, but an important thing about mistakes is to learn from them. Why did we make the mistake? Correct it. Don't do it again.
I think one of the maybe not as well understood aspects of football, is just what happens in a huddle. You know, how is business conducted? What's the tone there? Who's in control? What happens if the team's losing? Is there any type of huddle etiquette not to holler at or lose your temper?
Yeah, there sure is. There are two huddles, offensive huddle and a defensive huddle. And normally one man is assigned to call the plays. Offensively, it's normally the quarterback, and when he steps into the huddle, no one says anything or should say anything. I mean, some hotheads in the heat of battle can lose themselves, but it's, the quarterback will get that under control rather quickly. Defensively, it's usually a linebacker that calls the plays. Once the linebacker steps into that huddle, everyone else is quiet. Then they go back to fighting one another. You know, let the guy talk, and then they start calling each other names afterwards. But there definitely is a proper way to go about these things. Players can talk to themselves. When they see that quarterback's not in there, standing in that huddle, calling that play, yeah, they're talking to each other, they're fighting, but as soon as the man gets in there with the numbers, they have to. You know, you only have 25 seconds in college to run a football play from the last one, and 30 in professional football, so there isn't much time for any arguing or debate to go on.
When after you leave the huddle, and you go back in formation, and the football snapped, and you've received the football, you have what, like maybe 3, 4, 5 seconds to decide where to throw the ball and assess the whole situation and follow through on the plans that you made in the huddle, right?
Ideally, you'd like to know where you're going to throw the football before the snap of the ball. Again, you'd like to know that, but you're not always sure what the quarterback has to do once he gets it in his hand is decide where to go. And again, that decision can be made on his first, his second, or his third step as he's going back to pass. Quarterback usually knows where he's going to throw the football before he finally gets back there to throw the football. That comes from studying, again, and knowing how to read defenses. And what a quarterback or what a football team would do, the Philadelphia Eagles or anyone for that matter, they'll try and pass the football to where there are the fewest number of defensive people. You want a one-on-one situation, if possible, with one of your teammates. That's where you're going to try and throw the football. Well, there's an odd number of players dropping back usually, and sometimes even numbers are dropping back. You try to figure out where the fewest number of people are, and that's where they'll pass the football.
In your book, you say that that the other team can key into the personal mannerisms of a quarterback.
And vice versa.
What would they be reading, and how might they react?
Well, a quarterback sometimes types himself. He'll throw it to a certain side depending on his drop or where he's looking. One thing for sure, a quarterback's going to throw the ball where he's looking. You know, so defensive people read eyes a lot. They try to read the quarterback's eyes and see where he's going, but first they go to their areas. You get in a situation where a play has worked for you in the past, say a third down and four, you might come back to it, and teams will get to pick up on that. As I say, you end up typing yourself. Defenses do the same things, and that's why they study themselves. So they learn what they're doing as well and try to break the typing.
My guest is Joe Namath, and he's written a new book called Football for Young Players and Parents. Football is, of course, a sport of, you know, that's been described many times as controlled violence. Is there much gratuitous violence in football?
I don't know what you mean.
Well, for instance, after you've thrown the ball, you're still going to get rushed, right?
You're still going to get hit.
You're still going to get hit.
Yeah, most of the time.
Right. and that's part of the show. But
well,
it's not necessarily part of the play.
It's not necessarily part of the show, and it is very often necessarily part of the play. The quarterback doesn't have to have the ball in his hands to get hit, and the more you hit a guy, the weaker he gets, the tighter he's going to get, or he's going to get hurt. If you can knock a guy out of a game with a good, clean lick, that's a feather in your cap. That's what the pros like to do. Now, this book, by the way, is for youngsters and parents. We're not talking professional football. Professional football is a different game, as we talked about it being different from college football, and it's certainly different from Pop Warner and the games that we play for fun and enjoyment and camaraderie. Professional football is a cold-blooded business.
In what ways did you find it to be a cold-blooded business? How did that
reveal itself to you? Some guys have a job today, and they're fired the next day. Injuries can turn off a man's career. It's a profession where a guy may only last 2 or 3 years. On the average, 5 years, depending on the position. I think centers last longer than anyone else because the offensive center really has less ground to cover out there, and they traditionally have the longest careers. Cold-blooded game, you know, if you concentrate so hard on your football and you grow up to be a football player, you've forgotten sometimes to study the rest of life, to study another area that you should study, and how do you make a living, you know. Fortunately, if you are fortunate and have good coaches and good people at home or a good college coach, they'll demand that you do learn and get prepared for life after sports, because for all of us, it does end as far as playing the game goes. Cold-blooded, well, yeah, I've seen things happen. I saw where a guy was one quarter of a football game away from getting a bonus for the season. They benched him. They didn't let him play the fourth quarter of the last game that season, so they wouldn't have to pay him. That's cold-blooded to me. You know, if you're not doing a job out there, there's not much room for friendliness or sentiment. They just fire you a piece of meat, you know, and that's the way it is. It's very often not nice.
Would you be friends with players from the opposing team, the guys that had just been rushing you?
I'd try to be friends with all of them, sure. I want to be friends with every one of those guys. Maybe they wouldn't hit me as hard. That's not true. I mean, they'd hit you just as hard. Now, you know, guys you go to college with sometimes end up on other teams, and you play against one another. Hey, you get along well. There's mutual respect for the most part amongst athletes, I guess, and people in other professions, there are mutual respect. You know, they have mutual respect for one another. But athletes certainly do. Football players do. There are some guys that intensely dislike one another out in the football field. There are guys out there that you've never laid eyes on before. You don't even know his name, you know, a number or something, you know. But sure, you have some friends on the other teams, too. Sometimes on your own team, there are guys you may go for months without talking to. Anytime you have 50 and 60 people working together, things aren't always going to run smoothly, and you're going to have different philosophies, different opinions. But you've got to funnel your energy is in one direction, you know, as a team, and that's the only way you're going to win. But, yeah, I had friends on other teams, and I had guys on other teams I didn't like, guys that were dirty, you know. And the one thing we had in professional football, there's a saying said about one-eyed monster tells no lies, the one-eyed monster being the camera and film that we look at after every game and after every practice without any narration. And everybody knows what is supposed to get done. And that you look up that wall, it's embarrassing sometimes how badly we make ourselves look or how badly we perform. But you have to learn to deal with it, and you learn that guys make mistakes. Just have to correct the mistakes and bounce back.
What were the aspects of dirty playing that were most prominent?
Oh, when a guy has his back turned and a man would come up and hit him with a forearm in the back of the head for no reason at all other than just being a dirty ball player. I've seen that happen several times. I saw Lynn Swann almost, fortunately, there aren't a lot of players in the league like that. And it's kept at a bare minimum because there is also the unwritten payback rule. Usually, you know, our guys will get your guys, or if you guys get our guys in an unsportsmanlike manner. And that happened. I remember one time I got hit late. We were playing the Oakland Raiders. And this man hit me late and broke my cheekbone. My buddies on our team, I didn't leave the game. You know, they threw the flag and they did call the penalty when they walked it off. And when I got my senses back in my head, I had time, fortunately, because it was a penalty. I got in the huddle, and I said a few things. I was a bit upset. Anyway, we snapped the ball, run the next play, and as soon as that whistle blew and the play was over, my boy, Dave Herman, our right guard, went right to that dirty player on the other side and, you know, hit him. And they started one heck of a fight out on the football field. But that's, you know, your guys usually, there's that unwritten rule, payback, you know.
Now, is that payback frequently kind of invisible to the fans and
most of the time, yeah. Sure, most of the time, but it can be picked up now with the replays, especially on television with a smart director, somebody can get the right camera shots. Yeah, you can pick up some things, but a lot of the time it's not shown. The NFL certainly doesn't want to show itself being the nasty or the ugly or the bad side of it, and usually television cooperates.
What was the weekly cycle like? Beginning with Monday morning when you recuperate from the previous day's game?
Yeah, well, it varies from team to team. Some teams will come in the day after a game and study the film, loosen up, work out any kinks or tightness.
And I guess that Monday, it's really different if you've won or if you've lost day before.
Oh, man. But, you know, only two bad two bad things about professional football. Here I am telling you about guys beating up one another. I always used to say the only two bad things were losing and getting hurt. Losing was awful. What a drag. And there were many Monday mornings when I literally had to roll out of bed. I ached so much. You get dehydrated too. You sweat a lot. Your muscles tighten up. Anyway, a regular routine for one team would be to go in the day after a game, look at the films of the game, get graded, grade one another, and also get treatment from the trainer. Some teams will go in, I say, day after the game, then take Tuesday off, and then go back to work Wednesday. Some teams, when I was with the Rams, that's the way we did it. We went in the day after the game and took Tuesdays off. The Jets, for example, would take the day after the game off. Anybody could go in and get treatment or loosen up or whatever they wanted to do the day after, but it was normally the day off. Then Tuesday, you started working on the game plan that the coaches had put together, and it's like a movie script or a television script. It keeps changing every day. You know, guys keep seeing things that they'd like to try and do. Coaches keep seeing things as they get into the week. Injuries often change things up. So, you know, Usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, your hardest practice takes place, and then you taper off Friday and Saturday. You do very little practice. You'll just go out and loosen up and brush up on the mental part of it, and Sunday be ready to play.
What was it? Closer to dread or eager anticipation or somewhere in between? about Saturday night when you're revving up for Sunday's game?
Yeah, especially when you knew their team was better than your team and they were going to beat you up. We played against some tough teams when we weren't very sharp. And you said, oh, what are we getting into? We went to Cleveland to play one year. We had 24 roster changes, 24 new guys on our team 5 days before the game. This was one of the years that really wasn't much fun with the Jets, but it was a work year. Sure, you kind of dread some beatings you're getting ready to take and try and figure out how to win this game, you know, and it was lopsided. Yeah, and sometimes when you're playing against a weaker opponent, you're more relaxed, of course. You know, you're more confident, and so you're not as nervous, but man, that adrenaline always started pumping. There was always that nervous energy going before the game, man. That was the worst. I used to hate waiting for a night game, for example. Seems like you have to sit around all day. You look at films again. You have another meeting here, another meeting there. It's the longest day getting ready for a night game. It was a drag.
You became known for your high-living playboy lifestyle and received a lot of publicity and lots of magazine articles about that, about, you know, how you would stay out late at night and drink and run around, and booze and broads was almost synonymous with Joe Namath in terms of the magazine coverage that you got. How did the Jets management react to that?
First of all, I was a healthy young man, and that's why I like ladies, of course, and I think every healthy young man should to this day appreciate and like ladies, all right? The booze was a minimal thing because you have to be able to play and perform and practice and work, and so that was played up a little bit. I had, as I mentioned earlier, an owner, Mr. Werblin, who is a dear friend to this day. The first week I was in New York, he said, Joe, this is the greatest city in the world. I think he didn't get to Philadelphia very often then, you see. But he said, this is New York. I want you to learn New York. Get to know the people. Have the people get to know you. He said, now I want you to take your salary this first year and spend it. Don't even worry about this first year's salary. The money that we have protected and deferred will that's what's going to be important to you. He says, but I want you to enjoy New York. Well, I did. I got to know New York, and I got to know a lot of spots, especially at night, because Weeb Eubank had a theory also about practicing. He believed in practicing as close to game time as possible. Well, so I worked out my schedule. I figured, well, if we're going to practice, I had to be at the stadium at noon. I wanted to get 8 hours sleep, but, gee, I could get home at 2, 3 in the morning and get 8 hours sleep and get the practice on time. It was just a matter of readjusting the hours, that's all. But I took good care of myself physically. The two of the most important things that's ever happened to me in sports, and the most respected things, I believe, is were being elected captain at the University of Alabama and being elected offensive captain of the New York Jets. Now, your teammates do not elect a guy captain if they think he's out running around, not being prepared to come to work. I mean, they want a man that is, you know, knows what's happening, that's going to be prepared to go to work. And that's what I always say, you know, they point the finger at my nightlife and running around. But meantime, my teammates elected me captain every year from my fourth year on that I played. And that was a great tribute.
Well, one thing about your nightlife and the type of media image that accompanied that was that you began to be in great demand for product endorsements, especially those, you know, like men's cologne or shaving cream, those types of products that would benefit from having you promote them, somebody with a really positive, successful nightlife type image. Did you begin to realize the connection between all your press coverage and the fact that that made you really bankable for Madison Avenue?
Well, I've worked with a lot of companies in a lot of areas of endorsement over the years, not strictly cologne. I mean, popcorn poppers, popcorn, that's pretty wholesome. You know, I did an Ovaltine ad. You know, how bad is that? That has nothing to do with nightlife, Ovaltine. I've worked with a lot of people. I still work with Fabergé, as a matter of fact. They've said, people, advertising magazines have said recently that I'm lost some attractiveness to advertising because I got married. You know, I'm a proud father. I got married November 7th in 84, and we have a 10-month-old daughter. And they say because of my marriage, I've lost some attractiveness to advertising companies. Well, that's their problem, not mine, you know. The athlete, being in the public eye, was more important than the nightlife and my getting jobs, I believe. And New York City, you know, I think there in itself is the answer. There are more opportunities in New York City, certainly were anyway, for a successful athlete. And there still are today for a successful athlete. So I just happened to be in a town that I could get a lot of jobs. And most of them, if not all of them, worked out, you know, in the right direction.
Well, one of the commercials that you did that's written about frequently is the time that you shaved off your mustache.
Mm-hmm. And that was my idea.
Was that your idea?
That was one of my few bright ideas. Yes.
Well, it was reported that you were paid $10,000 to shave it off.
It was $15,000.
Well, it was $15,000, all right. it was underreported then. You only had one chance to do that, right?
I know, that's okay. Right. Okay. I wanted to shave. You see, what first, Danny, wait a minute. Our team decided to do that. We actually got a letter from the president of the American Football League that demanded us to shave, and we said, forget it. In fact, Weeb Eubank was smart enough not to show us the letter until we clinched the championship. What we did was decide to grow mustaches or beards until we clinched our division. Now, there were about 10 of us or 12 of us on the Jets that decided to do that. Okay, well, I was ready to shave, and I called the man sitting out here now, my buddy, Mr. Walsh, and I said, Jim, I'm getting ready to take this thing off. Let's see if anybody'd be interested in doing anything about it, a commercial or whatever. And sure enough, they did, and we did it live. Yeah, I mean, I actually only had one shot to take there. You know, it was a real mustache.
Well, so did you do anything to make sure that you got the right, because you only had one chance. It was a one-take shot.
It was electric razor. How far wrong could you go? I mean...
One of the most difficult things, I think, about playing football to people that just watch it on TV, especially during the winter, must be the fact that you have to play in the mud and, is, you know, when it's sub-freezing temperatures.
Awful. Oh, is it awful.
Did you ever adjust to that?
You know, you have to deal with it. Sure, you adjust some things. There are some things you can do on a football field as far as running and cutting that you can do on a dry field. And on a wet field, you simply can't do it. There are plays that you run that you can run on a dry field. And on a wet field, you just can't get the job done. Different stunts in the offensive line, you know, or defensive line, rather, when I say stunts. When two defensive linemen crisscross, for example, one will go to his right and the other one will go to his left to confuse the offense. Well, if it's muddy, they may not have the right footing. The worst for me was the cold weather. Oh, I hated the cold weather. We played a game. We lost to Kansas City Chiefs in championship game in New York. Kansas City won the Super Bowl that year. I believe it was 22 degrees. It was a 45-mile-an-hour wind. It had rained the day before, and we had to practice out there, and now the field froze. There were holes in the field 6 inches deep, 4 inches deep from footprints in the mud. Field was frozen. It was an awful day. That was the worst game I think I ever had to deal with. If we'd have won the game, I wouldn't have minded at all, but we lost the game, and so that's what made it lousy. But the weather certainly is a drag, and the fans are cheated out of a good performance. But at the same time, that's the nature of the game, too. That's what makes football football, you know. It's played under these conditions sometimes, and it's equal for both teams, so you have to deal with it.
How do you keep your hands agile when it's so cold?
That's what I was mentioning. The cold weather was the worst for me because it'd get dry. And when the hands got dry, the football would become very slick. You couldn't grip the ball as well as you'd like to. And for a passer, that's a drag. Professional quarterbacks could probably hit their target 9 out of 10 times. At least they can in practice. The main reason you don't hit your target is the ball slips out of your hand so often. And when it's cold, it really is that the pigskin does get slick and your hands are dry, and it's a very difficult thing to hold on to.
One of the sports legends of the United States is not an athlete, but a sportscaster, Howard Cosell. And he's not a man, I understand, that sees himself as an expert on football. Although he's,
he'll be the first to tell you he is the expert on football. on every phase of it.
On every phase of it. How did you get along with him?
I got along great with him the first 2 or 3 or 4 years. Now I wouldn't waste my breath even saying hello to him because he's a rat. I don't like Howard, and it's that simple.
I didn't know I was stumbling onto.
That's fine. You know, Howard is in my. Well, who cares? Let's talk about something else. No, what about Howard? Was the best at what he did, and the reason I appreciated him and his profession is, no one did not care about Howard. The viewer, the listener, always either liked him or disliked him, but there was no one out there, I don't think, that just didn't have an opinion on Howard. He was able to create controversy, create interest. He was brilliant at what he did. Right or wrong, he didn't have to be dealing with facts. I mean, he'd make up a story and he'd catch your ear. He was brilliant.
Somewhere I read you told a funny story about the time that Howard Cosell came to visit you.
It was great. It was pulled by a West Philadelphia or South Philadelphia boy, I might tell you. My roommate was a guy named Ray Abruzzi. He's from South Philly here. And hello to the Abruzzi people, by the way, if there are any of them listening. Raymond was sleeping, right? He's in the bedroom sleeping. Dick Schaap and I, Dick Schaap was with NBC at the time, he still may be. Dick Schaap and I were in the living room talking with Howard. I'm sitting on the couch, Howard's sitting in a chair, and Dick's in a chair, and Howard's talking. Raymond comes walking out of the bedroom just with his drawers on, wiping his eyes, and he looks up and sees Howard. He says, "Oh, Howard, I thought you were on television. I just came out to turn you off." Well, I'll tell you what, we died. I mean, Dick and I just started rolling. Howard was frozen, and then after about 10 seconds, Howard went on with, all kinds of remarks about the Italians, about Ray Abruzzi, about everything. It was a lot of fun, but I had a lot of fun with Howard. Howard flipped out. You know, I think success, star, quote, star celebrity, got to Howard's head. He really couldn't handle it.
Do you miss playing very much right now, or are you relieved?
If I thought I could play, Danny, I'd miss it. But I know I don't belong. I'm physically not fit. When I retired, I physically wasn't fit to play anymore. And so I got a better shake than I thought I'd get in the first place. As we said, I was told I could play 4 years. I ended up playing 13 professionally. So I lasted longer than I ever thought I would.
What do you look for when you think about doing either film or stage roles now in that part of your career?
Good script to start with, certainly. And that's one of the reasons I like theater, too. You can get some wonderful scripts to work with. Television and motion pictures sometimes you don't get the best, and then it's in someone else's hands by the time they put it together, and you don't have the end product that you'd like to see. But there are also actors that'll take on any kind of a script. I'll do acting. I'll stay in Los Angeles for the most part to stay with my family. And fortunately, I don't have to travel these days to work. I get a good shake in football and had some good guidance by Mr. Leon Hess and Mr. Werblin with some financial interest or investments over the years, so I'm in a decent enough position that I don't have to leave my family that often. But this is the first time I'm away from them, and I miss them both.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being here today.
I want to thank you for having me, Danny. I enjoyed it.
And my guest has been Joe Namath. He has a book out now. It's an instructional book for young players and for their parents. It's called Football for Young Players and Parents, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, it's 5 minutes to 5 o'clock. In 5 minutes, we'll be hearing tonight's edition of All Things Considered live from National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. I'll tell you what's coming up on Fresh Air for the rest of this week after this word from Shadow Traffic.
On the Schuylkill Expressway eastbound, generally slow from Gladwin to City. That's a 20-minute delay. Westbound, you're going to find slow traffic as you make your way between Gladwin and the area of the Conshohocken Curve. Traveling west on Vine Street, traffic is jammed from 16th to 22nd. Well, there's a disabled truck in the traffic lane, so therefore no one can get onto the Schuylkill Expressway because of that problem. Traveling into New Jersey and Southampton, 70 westbound west of the Red Line Circle, an accident. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded with a grant from the Philadelphia Electric Company. Well, tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be architect Witold Rybczynski, who's the author of A Short History of an Idea, which is about the evolution of homes, how we feel about our homes, its private spaces, how we use furniture. And we hope to open up the telephones during that interview. So if you have any questions or comments about the evolution of homes, then you can call tomorrow during that interview at 3 o'clock. Thursday at 4 o'clock, I'll speak with folklorist John Harold Brunvand, who's written a book on rumors and urban legends. He talks about things like the Avon Flasher and the Cabbage Pack Tragedy and the Mexican Pet. Those are all things that he writes about. Friday at 4 o'clock, we'll hear an interview which Terry Gross recorded with actor Alec Guinness, who will talk about his life on the stage and in the movies. And this Sunday, on the Best of Fresh Air at 6 o'clock, an interview with avant-garde composer and philosopher John Cage. He'll explain why he's committed to changing our preconceptions about music. Coming up in about 3 minutes, tonight's edition of All Things Considered from National Public Radio, followed by 91 Report at 6:29 on WHYY. The technical directors for today's show have been Jay Goldman and Ron Barron. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Judy Wiglarski is joining us for the next 2 weeks for production assistance. Also thanks to Abby Klibanoff for her production assistance. For Terry Gross, my name is Danny Miller. Thanks for listening. Thank you. You're listening to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up in a few moments.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
We are talking today about the first step towards war, in which the young people of this country will be directly involved.
In the Senate, a Democratic plan to stop aid to the Contras fighting for control of Nicaragua. The vote tonight on All Things Considered.
Also, President Reagan campaigning in Illinois offers some help to farmers who will have surplus grain.
Refugees from Sri Lanka found in boats off the coast of Newfoundland tell of paying to escape their country.
A new rocket designed from NASA to solve the problem of faulty seals.
And thunder and lightning and not enough rain, problems facing firefighters in the West.
Also, instructions on how to watch tonight's meteor shower.
That and more, now this news.
This is Mark Boardman, a House Subcommittee.